The Attack Zone, Episode 4, Evaluating Tournament Results. Hey everybody, welcome to another installment of The Attack Zone, where we cover the A to Z of competitive Dice Masters. This is Dave here, and joining me on the line, as he does every week, is good guy, all-around family man, Randy. How's it going, man?
Hey man, it's going well.
Excellent. How are things in your house now that, you know, you have adjusted, I'm sure, to the existence of a new little one?
Yeah, we're getting into the swing of things. I actually head back to work this week. I've been off work this whole time now, the past two and a half weeks since the baby's been born. I get a little bit of paternity leave, and then I was able to throw a little extra vacation time on the end there. So I'll be heading back to work this week, and that'll be a nice change of pace.
Really? So I would imagine that it would either be really difficult or really awesome. Like, because you have four running around now. Well, I guess one's not really running around at all yet.
Yeah.
But you have four around there, and I guess you have your hands full.
Oh, it's going to have its pluses and minuses for sure going back to work. But there is going to be that sigh of relief when I get in my car in the morning and, you know, for the next 8 hours or so, I don't have to worry about diapers. I don't have to worry about getting bottles ready.
I guess that would have its, yeah. So, conversely, going back to work from Origins was like the worst experience of my life. I mean, because Origins wasn't just a fun little trip or like your average vacation. I got to meet so many people. I got to hang out with people. You could just sit down and demo games, and they were there, and people would teach them to you and all kinds of stuff like that. I came back with all kinds of cool games, and it was just, it was beyond my imagination. I mean, I know other people are listening to this, and they're like, well, that's nothing compared to Gen Con or whatever else. But, I mean, they had almost just shy of 16,000 unique badges this year, a big enough con in its own right. And just getting to sit down and play so many games with so many people, and then have to go back to work. And, like, nobody there gets that passion. Like, you can't explain to anybody, well, I was just at this place where I got to play board games with a whole bunch of people, and I know what you're thinking, but it was like, whoa, you can't explain that. So,
oh yeah,
it was exceedingly tough.
I totally feel you on that one. I work in a place with a bunch of, you know, grizzled 40 and 50 year old machine workers, and I can't waltz right in there and be like, hey, I was playing board games all weekend, and it was a great time. And yeah.
How was your weekend? Well, I recorded a podcast about a game that you play with superheroes and dice. Oh, and Yu-Gi-Oh's in it, too. And they're probably like, okay, get this guy away.
Yeah.
Good enough.
Yep.
Well, luckily, we have an audience here that does share some of this passion. At least we hope. If you're not sure why you're listening. But so let's get into some stuff that we can share with them. Let's say we move right into the six-pack.
Let's do it.
All right. So as ever, we have six DC packs today. I think we'll change it up and do something different for the next one. We won't quite be at Age of Ultron, but I think it'd be neat to do a different set here. And this one, I got to say, let's look in here. I think it's going to be a pretty easy one for us here. So let's go on. Let's start with the commons. We have the common Captain Cold. You can pay a bolt and mess with blockers. He's a four-bolt villain. We have the common Red Tornado, which is just blank, so not a whole lot to say there. We have the common Firestorm, which I love. He's that 5-bolt Justice League that deals damage when bolt characters are fielded. We have the common Lex Luthor, and this is the one, when he's active, your opponent must pay 2 to use basic action dice. We have the common Booster Gold, which we must sadly skip. We have the common Vibe. When he's KO'd, deal 1 damage to all characters and players. And finally, we have the common Harley Quinn, Dr. Harley Quinzel. She's that 3 mask villain that, you know, makes Joker a little bit easier to purchase and field. So I think one is going to be sticking out here, our favorite power common, right?
Yeah, Firestorm. He's the only one that really stands out from that whole group.
Yeah, all right. I agree. There's nothing else that I look at that I say, ooh, I want this instead. So let's move on then to the uncommons with Firestorm, our leader in the clubhouse. We have the uncommon Lex Luthor, 4 shield villain. He's the one who, when you use a basic action die, you can reroll it to try and get it into prep. We have the uncommon Vixen, a 3 mask. When she blocks, she can get +2 defense. Uncommon Cyborg, a 4-fist Justice Leaguer. He can get that +2/+2, and he has retaliation. I think that's when he attacks alone that he gets that. And then he has retaliation, too, for those Justice League characters. And I think that's it for uncommons. So, do you have anything that unseats the Firestorm there?
No. I like Cyborg, but I really don't think that there's anything that we could see in our second pack that would make me want to choose him over Firestorm.
Yeah, Cyborg is good. That uncommon is not a bad play. Getting +2/+2 when attacking alone, having that Justice League affiliation, there are lots of ways that he can work, but right now I look at Firestorm. If I have that, that almost is always going to dictate what I'm doing, unless maybe my second pack has no bolts at all and I see no bolts on the table. That would be unlikely. But let's look at the rares and see if anything changes our mind. We have the rare Swamp Thing. He's 5 mask. If this character damages an opponent, knock out an opposing character. And then finally we have the rare Sinestro, 5-fist villain here. Your villains cannot be the target of opposing global abilities. So probably nothing there that's going to make us change our mind from Mr. Firestorm here, huh?
No. Nope. I mean, even if we saw Aquaman in the second pack, which would be pretty much best case scenario for Cyborg, yep. I think I'd still want to combo that Firestorm up with Aquaman instead.
I agree. It works too well. It works too well for us to go a different direction. There are so many different ways to play it. Even if you can't get that Cheetah or that Hawkman, there are still lots of good things you can do with the bolts. Plus, you're still open to Justice League, which gives you a whole other avenue of opportunities.
Yeah.
So, all right, good enough then. That is our pick from the 6-pack, and we both agree, I think, that not a whole lot in Pack 2 that could change our mind. Firestorm, Jason, and Ronnie, how we love you. All right, all of that being said, then, let's move into our feature topic. And this is one we had talked about for a little while, but is especially very timely right now. And that is because we are talking about properly judging tournament results. So I think there are a lot of mistakes that people make when they are when they look at a tournament. You know, we just had Worlds happen, of course. There are a lot of common mistakes that people make when they look at a tournament like Worlds, and they say, oh, you know, this deck won. I'm playing this deck. This is the best deck.
Yeah.
And it's not just looking at what won and saying, I'm going to use this. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself, but it's also that hyperbole that we throw in. This is the best deck. And there's a lot more that goes into that than, well, that. So I think we want to start with the idea, Randy, that it's not just the decks that won, right?
Oh, no. No, there were so many great decks there that, you know, I mean, probably made the top 16. I mean, you could look at any of those teams that made the top 16, and that's, you know, real good, competitive, solid, all of them had a chance of winning, I'd assume.
Well, let's even go a step beyond that. I mean, top 8, top 16 in any tournament, that's kind of arbitrary, right? A close game or two goes a different direction, and the field just looks very different. Plus, we're talking about dice anyway. I mean, dice can be very fickle, and that can affect a lot of different things. So, a close game or two, even a not close game where, you know, your key character just came up energy turn after turn after turn after turn, and you watch your life slowly whittle away.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to affect what that field looks like. That could be the difference between 3-2 and make it, and 2-3 and don't.
Yeah, I know, we've talked about it before, but I mean, me and you took just about the same, I mean, the same exact team to U.S. Nationals, and we both had a very similar strategy on how to play that team. And, you know, some of the rolls went your way. You made top 8. The rolls didn't go my way, and I didn't make it.
Yeah. Now, imagine that I hadn't been there at all, and that deck just goes 1-4.
Yeah.
In the second one. I mean, obviously, it was good enough to qualify, but imagine that deck just goes 1-4 in the second day. Does that mean that it's a bad deck? No way. I mean, it doesn't at all, but does that mean it's the best deck, you know, because it got top 8? Well, no, it doesn't mean that either. It's very, very difficult to judge those sorts of things. I mean, top 8 and top 16 numbers, those are arbitrary. That's a cut that we make. And when we're talking about a game that's as high variance as this, there are so many things that go into it. You can't just look at that. The other thing is sample size. The number of teams and games played, whether you're talking in the tournament or even just what you did playtesting leading up to a tournament like this, it's not big enough to tell you what you need to know. So for example, if I sit down and I play one team versus another and I go 4-5 in that matchup, say I'm even going 4-5 from going second, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's an 80% matchup. You need a lot of games before you can arrive at the idea that, you know, this is the equity of this matchup every time, and I've pinpointed it. In fact, who knows, maybe it's actually like a 90% matchup and you actually just did really bad in a couple of those games. It's hard to say, but chances are it's probably worse too.
But yeah, we're talking about, you know, these sample sizes. I mean, there are so many ways that the dice can roll, and there are so many, I don't know, man. I totally lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
No, you're on the right you're on the right track completely, Randy. There are so many ways that the dice can go. There are a lot of different combinations of teams here. But regardless of any of that, you can't just sit down in your playtesting and say, you know, I won. Even if you say I won 80 out of 100 of these games, that's still not really that big a sample size in the grand scheme of things when you're talking about all of the different probabilities that can work together and everything else. So, I mean, that's the one thing is like, okay, this won, and now I sat down and I took this to my local store and I went like 6-1 on a game night. Well, that doesn't actually tell you a whole lot. So the evaluation isn't just in what we take from the tournament itself. It's also in, like, how we react to it and, like, what decks then we take from it to try and work with ourselves. So, yeah, you can't really just sit there and work on the equity of those matchups. I'd also say it goes back to, again, your own playtesting when you're preparing for something like this. A really common one that I see, and this is maybe more into just plain old determining game results, let alone a big tournament, is saying, okay, I'm 80% against this deck, as much of a mistake as it would be for the sake of discussion, we'll put a number to it. I'm 80% against this deck, I'm like 20% against this other deck. So you start to like figure out how can I be better against this deck that I'm really bad against. And then you start moving a card here and there, and maybe you've raised your equity in the one, but then you never go back to check what's the equity in that initial matchup. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it becomes very difficult there to try and tweak, and you kind of have to take a macro perspective and maybe even an internal perspective and not look at how do I respond to everything and more at how do I make this do what it wants to do the best way that it can.
Yeah. I'm a good example of this. When me and JT were playtesting a couple of different team ideas, I came up with my Fireball team that I wrote an article mm-hmm. about recently. And I wiped the floor with him, like, 6 games in a row. And we're like, oh my gosh, this is the best team ever. What can possibly stop this team? And we were just basing our opinion, you know, on those 6 games that went my way. Yeah, it was 6 games, and 6 in a row sounds like a great streak. But it's nowhere near indicative enough to, you know, really base any concrete facts on.
Oh, sure. And we see this all the time. I mean, let's talk about another game that's rife with numbers and statistics and probability. Baseball. We're in the full swing of baseball season. In fact, as we're recording this, the Buccos just swept the Phillies today. So I love that. Sorry, Philadelphia. I love that. Several years ago, when the Pirates were still in the midst of their, you know, futility streak, they started off a season something like 15-1. It was like, my gosh, here we are. They've arrived. They've been building to this. Well, when you're talking about a season that goes 162 games, 17 is 10%. That's a drop in the bucket. More than a drop if we're talking 10%. But nonetheless, that's a very small amount of games. And, of course, they did come back to earth. And, as I said, that was right in the middle of their futility streak. So you can imagine how that turned out. But you can't look at those isolated cases. You have to look, again, at a little bit of a, of a broader perspective. So I think if we flip back to the tournament results, it's not so much, here's what won, so this is the deck. It's, here's what won, so let's put a flag in that and try and learn something about it. Or let's put a flag in it and test a few different scenarios out with it. Let's come back to it. Let's learn something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
it's
there's...
It's about putting a...
I think there's really something to learn from the... I mean, not just what worked well in this best team, but, you know, what worked well in these 20 teams we saw, and, you know, how many of them used this card well, how many of them used that card well. I think, I mean, not just looking at, I mean, even taking it bigger than just one team and seeing how one team did over the course of a, you know, a period of time, it's looking how this card is doing on multiple teams in multiple scenarios, and I think that's what's going to give you an idea of what's good and what's not.
Well, sure. Though, you know, then you risk falling into another similar trap. I'm glad you brought that up, where people start talking about, well, you know, X percent of top 16 teams had this card on their team, so it must be an amazing card. Now, in some cases, that may well be true, and they're cards that we've already evaluated to know that they're good cards on an island. Good cards in the meta? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, it's not like you have a 100% clear idea of what it's going to look like when you bring that card to the table, when you decide this is what I'm taking with me. You don't really know some of that until you sit down. And then you also got to get into, you know, those individual matchups. So it's not just, again, the form that it took, but the function. In both cases, we want to know the why and the how. How was that card used in this tournament? You know, we saw a fair amount of Black Widow Tsarinas, and sometimes she can still do pretty well in a game. But we've also seen where she's used instead of an early game like Beat Stick, she's kind of that late game, cheap, close-the-door kind of character sometimes, too. So it's not just, what's the character? Okay, I know how to use it. It's, well, how were they using it, and how did it work in the context of what they were trying to do? But you know, once again, just as we're talking about with decks, it's the same with cards. Okay, so this was on a lot of those teams. Let's try and learn something about why it was like that.
Yeah.
So I think the other thing to bring up here, another very important point and a pitfall that I think we saw some people kind of fall into here, including some of us at Worlds. We looked at teams like the Johnny Swarm that Truby ran. And you can see all these teams, by the way. There was an article on our website a couple days ago. We had a chart linked there where the columns were all the teams, and it showed that we're top 16, and it showed sort of the distribution. That's what you can reference here to kind of know what we're talking about. So the Johnny Swarm with Truby, or the Dragons team that Michael Lee ran, right? They aren't necessarily... There are different cards that are a part of it, but that doesn't mean that it's a different win condition. You have to look at the cards as separate from how they're winning. Like, fundamentally, and you and RJ mentioned this on the Reserve Pool podcast last week, giving me a break. I'm so glad you gave me a break, and I'm so glad you mentioned this. Oh, and by the way, I have to say, if you didn't listen to that out there, please do. There's an interview with Dean. They did a great job holding down the fort. It was an excellent, excellent episode. I couldn't have left the Reserve Pool in better hands for a week than I did with the two Randys here. But in any case, look at Michael Lee's team. So how was he trying to win? Well, he used the breath weapon that the Dragons had to generally clear the board on the other side and then swing with a whole bunch of damage. Is that really that fundamentally different from clearing the board with Hulk Green Goliath and swinging for a whole bunch of damage?
Nope.
No. Let's look at Dean. Dean had some interesting pieces in his deck. He had the Solomon Grundy. He had the Deadpool. He had the Storm Weather Witch. But Gobby and Johnny Storm were pretty much a very large part, in fact, of how he wanted to win. That's not new. No, that's not a criticism. finding new ways to work with the wind condition and protect it are good. And, of course, it's the Solomon Grundy usage that gets a lot of eyeballs, and including mine and probably yours, too. But it was Gobby and Firestorm, you know, and Johnny Storm. Let's look at Truby. You know, he's going with Human Torch and a whole bunch of Swarm characters. I mean, we're doing a whole lot of it's a weenie rush with Human Torch. Not new. New way of implementation. I think the one thing that we probably did see that was a bit newer was the way that people tried to control with Constantine now in the mix with Jinzo and some of the removal options like Millennium Puzzle. Millennium Puzzle really having supplanted Psylocke as removal of choice among many players at Worlds. And, of course, we'll have to see going forward, does Solomon Grundy start to replace Millennium Puzzle? But regardless of any of that, that would be maybe the new thing, but it doesn't necessarily look that interesting because a lot of people had that. The team that I brought had, I think, used a lot of the top 10 to 15 cards that were here, and I ran into some pretty bad matchups, and it got in my head, and I had some pretty stupid plays. What are you going to do? But even that's not that different because we had some controlling elements before, and certainly these teams did. I wouldn't call them wholesale control, though.
I think us at the reserve pool as a group, we expected to see a little more control elements than what we saw.
I expected like a tighter brand of control.
Yeah,
I think is really what it was. Lord of D and the Ring of Magnetism were around, but they didn't really have the kind of presence that you would have thought going into this. In fact, I'm looking here, but I don't believe there were more than only one team actually did bring the Ring of Magnetism, and they did not bring the Lord of D.
In
terms of the top 16,
I know we discussed that on our forums a little bit right after Worlds. Dean and a few other players chimed in like, yeah, that's a solid combo. It's just not reliable enough. And, maybe that's the case because you are relying on two dice. But who knows? Maybe next time a tournament rule comes around, someone decides, you know what? I'll play the odds. I'll take that team. I'll take that combo. And it comes up for them, throughout the tournament. All of a sudden, it's going to look like, oh, this combo is viable again. Well, it's just as viable as it was before. It's just now we're back to our sample size.
Right. Well, it shares a lot of the same problems that some of the combo early kill teams do, which is, you really ideally want two die faces to come up. Like, you need them both to come up, character/action, at the same time on the same turn.
Yeah.
Now, you can get just the Lord of D in the field and wait for the basic action, or for the action to come back around. But it's also just as likely that you get the action and no Lord of D. So it's a difficult one there. I think when we talked about what we were going to take to Nationals, the great thing about the team that you and I used, Randy, is that it could win on turn three. But that wasn't how the deck wanted to win. The deck wanted to win by getting Hulk out and clearing a whole bunch of space and then swinging at you.
Yeah.
Now, along the way, it might beat you on turn three. But it didn't have to. The problem with Lord of D-Ring is that it doesn't necessarily have an out. Even if I'm taking a team like High Hopes and I'm saying, I want to win on turn three, well, it gives itself an out by including that Hulk and some of the other tech that was in there. In this case, there's not a whole lot you can do. And the other problem is that Lord of D-Ring is not a win condition in and of itself. It can frustrate your opponent, but it doesn't really stop anything. It's too broad an answer to really handle threats.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say as far as that goes. But the overarching point is win conditions are different from the cards. And if you really break down some of the teams that we think, wow, this was really different, start to look for how it's actually winning, because you're going to start to see some patterns. We had another gentleman here who brought, who did Gobby, but he also had Firestorm and Cheetah. So not too fundamentally different from what you're trying to do with a Gabi Johnny Storm team, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, then he had a lot of use for bolts, and he had some of the removal and some of the cheap characters too. But, you know, that's not that different. It's a different way of doing the same thing. That's not bad. That's not to say that it's not creative. That's how we start to see archetypes form. So, in fact, that's a very good thing for the game.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, whether you're going to, you know, try to use Gabi and direct damage your opponent to death, or you're going to use Hulk or Breath Weapon to sweep the field and then rush for 20 damage, it's, you know, there's only so many ways you can do 20 damage to your opponent and win. But right. Now that the game has been out for over a year, and we've got, what is it, five more sets coming out this year?
Five out total. We don't have five more coming this year. We have Age of Ultron, War of Light. I would be shocked if, despite what they said, I don't believe that Ninja Turtles will actually appear this year. And I would be shocked if Amazing Spider-Man does appear this year.
Okay.
It wouldn't be till December.
Okay.
So at most three.
So they're planning on four, probably three. But, okay, regardless, they have
maybe two.
They have that many sets on the horizon that is only going to increase the variability of, you know, ways to you can reach those win conditions.
Right.
And everyone's going to have their own cup of tea. The more diverse card pool we have, people are going to find ways to do exactly what they want, you know, to every particular energy role.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, in general, if you just look from a big perspective and say, okay, this Firestorm team involving Storm, this Fireball team involving Storm, it's not really that different from what a Gabi might be trying to do, right? Because you're sitting back, you're not attacking, mm-hmm. and you're dealing direct damage. Now, I mean, in practice, it works a bit differently, but that's the true with this, with these cases too. You know, Breath Weapon happens at a different time than how you can trigger Hulk. You have to trigger it in a different way than how you can trigger Hulk. But the end result ends up being fairly similar.
Yeah.
Don't be too enamored with everything was so different. It was, but not in the way you'd necessarily think. And this is where we kind of get into a little bit of the hyperbole, and this is just all over the place in every CCG since the dawn of CCGs, or I guess TCGs as they were at the dawn of them. Hyperbole. The best card. The worst card. The best deck. The worst deck. This is horrible. This is amazing. This is unbeatable. We all do it. It's all there. We probably fall into that trap as much as anybody else because we got to get excited about all these cards, and we're trying to bring that excitement home to you and all that kind of stuff. But the best, is it really? The worst, is it? I don't think that it's really a good way for us to evaluate things, and it's certainly not always true. I mean, it's the best, .. Your mileage may vary.
Yeah. Yeah, you could add, you know, the tagline, the best in this given sample size on this given weekend with this many players.
Exactly. Exactly. That's quite a disclaimer. That's maybe more than at the end of a pharmaceutical ad. It's the best if.
Yeah.
Or it was the best of this time. But that doesn't actually tell you a whole lot. So beware of falling into that trap and beware of kind of buying too much into it when you hear it from somebody else. Somebody else says that, and they're serious, make them explain it to you. Why? You know, what are the next few words? Because as we said at the very beginning, we're not just about the form, what does the decklist take, but the function too. That's why we talked a lot about decklist visualization and how we imagine where our cards fit into our team and what we can do with that and how that leads us to evaluating the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Right? That's key to understanding our deck. So if somebody says it's the best, well, I don't know about that. How is it the best? In what situations is it the best? How did you find it worked? Was it always ideal? You know, and you have to be honest with yourself with some of this stuff too, because playtesting could happen. You go 9-6 against maybe a tough matchup. and somebody might walk away and say, oh, this is good. I was able to come out on top against this tough matchup. But if you're honest with yourself, it's like, wow, in all these wins, just all my roles just happened to come up right when I needed them. Well, that doesn't really mean that you really played at a 9-6 pace against it, despite the record that you that played out there. So watch some of the hyperbole as we evaluate some of these things. So I guess all that said, let's actually do just a little bit of evaluation, and let's frame it with some of the deck building lessons that we took from Worlds. But before I go into it here, Randy, were there some specific lessons that you took after seeing the teams that were winning? And how they were structured and how people were playing them?
Nothing really stood out to me as, you know, on that end. It's, I mean, like you said, a lot of these teams, they tried to go for win conditions that we've already seen before. It was just new ways of getting there. I mean, I guess mm-hmm. it was, you could tell there was a familiarity there with, mm-hmm. But the teams that were successful were the teams that were, you know, not forgetting the little things. That's one constant throughout. You can win games and get lucky, but even if you're getting lucky rolls, it is hard to win consistently if you're not familiar with your team and what it can do, what it's capable of. If you just, you know, if my buddy gives me a team list and I say, hey, I'll take this to the tournament, I'm not going to, you know what to do in crunch time, and you could see some of the players were really thinking their moves through very, mm-hmm. very carefully, and, you know, now I'm going to trigger this effect and pass priority, now it's back to me, and now I'll do this, and now it's your turn. And, like, things were very, very well thought out for the teams that we were seeing on the stream, which was, for the most part, the teams that continued to do well.
Yeah, absolutely. The teams that are on the stream, that are on the feature table, are you know, the folks who have been winning through the rounds. You actually bring up an important point there. Two things. First is that, as you say, the decisions were easy for them. There was familiarity. That's because they made a lot of those decisions before they ever came to play. They did it through playtesting. The second thing does talk about some of that consistency and understanding of how the deck needs to work. There's an idea that some people have, and maybe I'd have to speak with him, but I believe that maybe JT kind of got bit by this bug after we saw some of the crazy variants of the first couple of days of qualifiers. That I'm just going to bring... It's the idea of maybe needing to bring the team that can go... that can just hit on all cylinders and go like 6-0 or 7-0 or whatever you need to get to the end, depending on how many rounds of Swiss you have and whatever else. It has that high variance win condition that, like, okay, if I roll this and this and a miracle occurs, I win on turn three. Now, of course, JT's team was far more consistent than what I'm implying there. But I think in talking about it, I think he may have fallen into that trap a little bit. Like, okay, well, I know how to play this team, and it can win real fast, but it can't always win real fast. And that tends to be the problem with those kinds of things. You don't really need a team that's going to go undefeated. You just need a team that can go like at like a 4-2 pace, right? Because all you really need to do is, like, if you can get to kind of that 3-2, 4-2 kind of record, depending on how many rounds of Swiss there are, you're going to have a good shot at qualifying, especially if your wins came at, you know, at the right time, unless it's a weak 3-2. You're going to have a good shot at qualifying.
Yeah, if you're...
And then from there on out...
If you can win 2 out of every 3 games you play, hey, that's...
Exactly.
That's doing pretty well.
If from there on out, if you can go 2-1, you know, with some consistency, then you're going to have a good shot to win the whole thing. You don't need a completely unbeatable team in all scenarios. You just need a team that you can play to that kind of a record again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
So always opt for consistency. And I think that's what I took... those are the two points I took from what you said. So stepping back from it then, the lessons I took from Worlds were more about deck building in general. And I think I've brushed upon this in a couple of articles recently, especially the one dealing with the sine curve that evolved from a conversation that Dave Walsh and I had. But if you look at all of these teams, especially the teams that had the most success, they had a win condition that was, one, clearly identifiable, two, compact, as in it didn't have a lot of cards involved with it, and three was consistent. It didn't rely on these two or three dice come up the right face at the right time. It didn't rely on, you know, a big confluence of events. It was more about over time, consistency over time in the game. So, I mean, that's the first facet that really stands out to me when I look at these teams. I'm just as happy to field Gabi if I don't have Human Torch out yet. I'm just as happy to get those sidekicks there to fuel that Gabi. I don't have to have Human Torch yet. Human Torch is a nice bonus. It helps speed things up, keep the clock ticking a little bit faster. I don't need it yet, right? My dragons can come through with Breath Weapon whenever. I can clear your board and get some damage in if I need to. Things like that. So they didn't necessarily involve a ton of cards, and they had consistency built around them. So I think what we saw with deck building was starting with that win condition, adding some consistency and ramp around that, whether it's Blue Eyes, Professor X, anything else. Protecting from threats.
Man, how many prismatic sprays did we see?
We did. But then we also saw people who were worried about prismatic spray wanted to find a way to do it. So let's take this then, right? So win condition, consistency, and protection from threats, and apply this to some of the teams. Let's look at Dave Walsh's team. We were just talking about him. And Dave was worried about prismatic spray. He didn't want to see it happen. So what he did was he used Dragon Protector, Doom Calibur Knight, the common.
The Skeletal Warrior. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was one of two people that brought that. Skeletal Warrior, when it's in the field, if an opponent uses a basic action die, you cancel that effect and knock out Skeletal Warrior. It's a direct counter spell for any action die. That's going to stop Prismatic Spray. There was a lot of spray going around at the tournament. It was definitely there. I think on four or five different teams. Yeah, four in the top 16. And Dave didn't want that to threaten his ramp or other things that he might want to do on his opponent's turn. He was worried about that as protection for how he wanted to win, which is to ramp up and go with that formerly Weapon 10 the way that he likes to do. So he brought a means of dealing with it. I think that if I have to evaluate this, I think a mistake that Dave made was including that Manticore, Greater Beast. I understand why he did it. There was some swarm going around, but I think if you really look at what we saw on the Worlds, like, it was there in the qualifiers here and there, but I think if you really look at what you saw on Worlds, it's really only Truby who is taking full advantage of swarm. I mean, there are one or two other teams, but it was mostly Truby who was taking huge advantage of that swarm. So he built in a counter to something that wasn't necessarily everywhere, and it could work against the sidekicks, except if by the time you get that Manticore out, some sidekicks are already fielded. Now you have to go to work damaging those sidekicks, and in the meantime your Manticore might get knocked out. I think if you talk to Dave, he would say that he wants that slot back. Maybe he would have hulked something. He would have put a Hulk in there or something else that could have given him a better equity in the matchup with Dean. But I think if you talk to him, he'd say he wants that slot back.
Well, and even building upon that, talking about preparing for threats, one threat that he didn't prepare for was distraction, because mm-hmm. a way to protect from distraction is using the other Doom Calibur Knight.
Right.
And lo and behold, Dean had distraction. And so...
Yeah.
I mean, Dave Walsh, He had to weigh the options at some point. What am I more afraid of, distraction or prismatic spray? And he went with, you know, preventing the action cards, preventing prismatic spray, and left himself susceptible to distraction, which I know me and RJ touched on. I mean, he might not have even gotten to the finals if he would have taken the other Doom Calibur Knight, but that's just the way the matchup played out.
That absolutely is. And, of course, Dean was the only one who had distraction. So, I mean, there you go. He was perhaps right in a way to not prepare for distraction, because nobody else had it. It just so happened that at the end of the day, it was that last matchup that did have it, and that was going to put a cramp in Dave's style, not being able to actually attack with a formerly Weapon 10 Wolverine is going to stop that team from winning pretty much any time. So, yeah, but so let's look at Dean's team, because I really like what Dean put together here. We have a pretty understandable core here. We have the Gabi, and we have the Johnny Storm. That's your win condition right there, Gabi yeah. and Johnny Storm. So let's look at how he protects from threats. There are a few different ways. So if I think about Gabi, for one, I'm obviously worried about things that might either like ping my sidekicks off the field or things like that. I'm probably, you know, that probably kind of gets into the human paladin inclusion. Stop my characters from being able to be impacted by globals. Johnny Storm can't go anywhere. Gabi can't go anywhere. If I get into a game where my sidekicks are not viable and I actually have to swing with these characters, well, now they can't be distraction back. That's going to stop some of your globals from being used against you, which is pretty nice. His own, like, you know, that mystic box that he brought has the transfer power global on there. It's the same global. Well, that global can't be used against him if he gets that human paladin out. So it kind of gives some protection, some hedging your bets against something like that. Let's look at the Solomon Grundy. It's not just the fact that Solomon Grundy is something that you don't expect. I think it's also the fact that he had that storm with the global that lets you retarget a basic action, or excuse me, any action. So if he had got Millennium Puzzle, which was the removal that most other people were using, that could have been retargeted. But Solomon Grundy's not going to be retargeted. It's not going to happen. And now, thanks to his inclusion of Blue Eyes White Dragon, he has removal that can be used on either player's turn. If it's done on his turn, he gets a discount on buying something else. If it's done on his opponent's turn, he gets to roll Grundy next turn and maybe do it again or be ready to do it again.
Yeah.
So there's some removal for anything that stands in your way. Oh, shoot, you got that Constantine out, and that's going to mess with my when fielded ability that Gabi has. That's gone. Or you got that Hulk out. I don't want Hulk. The last thing I want to see is Hulk. I don't want Green Goliath sweeping all my sidekicks away. So now your Hulk is knocked out.
Yeah, and another thing, that Storm Weather Witch, I mean, the most popular basic action we saw was Polymorph. Storm can shut that down, providing that you also have something in your field to change the target to. That's a global that can shut down the most popular basic action amongst the top 16.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Polymorph, we didn't just see being used to bring something out, you know, offensively. We saw it being used defensively as well.
Yes.
And Storm can help guard against the defensive Polymorph. Maybe even the idea of, oh, geez, I don't want you to field this guy. I know you're going to roll this Gabi that you just bought next turn because most of your dice are on the field. I don't want that to happen. So I'm gonna get your Gabi out in the field, and that's not fielding him. Ha ha. Now he didn't do damage to me on that turn. You know, or I'm going to get this Human Torch off the field. Well, I redirected that thanks to Storm.
Yeah.
It helps deal with anything that could mess with you in some fantastic ways.
And I don't know.
So he gave himself a lot of options.
And I don't know how all of his games went. But seeing his basic actions of Distraction and Mystic Box, I don't know how often he was buying those. And I don't believe he had any other action dice on his team.
No, but he had characters that worked like actions. You know what I mean? Solomon Grundy is essentially Millennium Puzzle. But it's Millennium Puzzle that has legs and can block.
No, but the point I was making was he brought Storm, so his opponent could use that global as well. But he wasn't using any actions where it could hurt his strategy. At the very worst, they could change the target back to what the original target was, you know, by using the Storm global after he already used it. But there was nothing that Storm Global was going to do to disrupt his strategy.
No, that's absolutely the case. That's absolutely true, and good point by you. So let's look at Let's look at another team here. Let's talk about one that people have been talking about. That would be the Dragons team here. So what this team was doing was using blue, red, and green dragons to just kind of do a whole bunch with Breath Weapon and win. And he was buying transfer power because he would try and get that red dragon out. And then he could use transfer power twice, in fact, to try and get a couple more dragons out if he wanted to. Now, that's more the high variance play. He didn't have to do it that way. But, you know, it did kind of work for him here and there. He was using some of the Kobold ramp here. He was not relying on Professor X alone, though he did have Professor X. And he had Millennium Puzzle for removal, and he had Constantine to deal with those when-fielded effects. So, I mean, I think that he could have probably shored a couple things. Oh, and he did have Prismatic Spray as well. And he had Lord of D, which is wonderful, because now his dragons can't be affected by abilities. If you get him on that burst phase, Lord of D just essentially Lord of D's up all of the dragons. Who needs Ring of Magnetism?
Yeah. Yeah, it's... That's protection from so many things if it's on the burst.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I guess the question is... I'm sorry. He did not have Professor X. My eye jumped to the wrong line here. So he has Prismatic Spray for ramp disruption, or just to, like... The way I'm seeing this is if I'm doing a direct damage team like he is, I don't want that damage to trigger something on the other side of the board. Maybe it is that storm somehow in the field that we're talking about that you like for your Fireball team. Maybe it is that Hulk, whatever else. Well, Prismatic Spray wipes away those abilities. Makes it very simple. Lord of D is a very actually simple and effective way of protecting your own dragons. And maybe he doesn't come. Maybe he doesn't come on that burst phase. But you know what? With 10 polymorphs in the top 16, and you're one of the top 16, so... You know, 10 of 15 teams that you could see are going to give you the possibility of spinning that up. I like those odds.
Yeah, I'd spin a dragon down to spin up Lord of D, get that protection.
Sure, sure, absolutely I would. So, I mean, he built some protection in a round. I mean, easy protection is to think about things like removal, and Constantine was surely a popular one on 11 of 16 teams in terms of, you know, mess with when fielded stuff. But, you know, he didn't have to be too concerned about what are my opponent's characters. Unless they had a bad trigger, there's not a whole lot that your opponent's going to be able to do about some of those dragons coming at you. So, especially getting that Lord of D in there. Let's talk about another... This was a fun team to watch here. Let's talk about Truby. So, Truby's team was basically... Kobolds and Sturge swarming around the field, getting Human Torch Johnny Storm out there to get that when-fielded trigger going off. And his basic actions were transfer power and anger issues, so he could buff things up or he could steal opponents' abilities. So the number one thing I'm worried about is, all these swarm things have one defense. Magic Missile is going to be really bad for me. Well, not if I have Human Paladin, which, if I field him, my stuff can't be the target of that. You know? Maybe my opponent's going to field something that will remove, you know, like a Psylocke or something else that will remove my blocker. Well, not so much, or excuse me, my swarmer, like the guy in the field. Not so much if I have Constantine to kind of help me out there. You know, Prismatic Spray to kind of help him gain advantage over other people who then could not maybe use their own Professor X on their turn. The interesting includes here, and I don't know how much use he got out of them, were the Black Canary and the Iron Man Philanthropist. I guess getting some life back from the Iron Man isn't too shabby. But I think mostly he looked at what's the number one threat to my swarmers. Okay, it's going to be, you know, stuff that my opponent can use to affect it. So if I take Prismatic Spray, I can just wipe everything they have. If I take Human Paladin, my swarmers are safe from at least, you know, maybe 50% of what can get to them. So we see the win condition, which is swarming and Johnny storming. I've heard this called Johnny Swarm. And then we see some of the protection with Human Paladin. It's just how it works. And how are we going to be more consistent with this? Well, For one, it's Swarm. You just got to get stuff in the field, I guess. I guess Swarm is a hard one to control the consistency of. I think on a lot of the other teams, what we see controlling consistency is anything that allows you to do ramp, right? It's that blue eyes, or it's that it's going to let you consistently re-roll and refill that Gobby, that lets you knock out that Solomon Grundy, that lets you get a discount and get something into prep.
Yeah,
those are things that help consistency. And I think if you look across the teams, you see all of those kinds of tools. I think in general, the win conditions are easily identifiable. They have stuff built around them for consistency. And they have stuff going for threats. And when you're building for threats, don't think what you want to threaten. Don't think I'm bad against this kind of a team, so I want to disrupt that kind of a team. Because now you have 1/8 of your deck slotted, slotted to only deal with one kind of thing. Look and say, what do I not want to have used against me at all? Okay, now what card can I use to deal with that? I was playing against Lauren in a game, and she was trying that massive damage Wolverine Overcrush thing with the... which Wolverine is that?
I can't think of the name of it.
The best there is, yes. The 5-cost Wolverine from Uncanny. Let me say, you can stomp over somebody with that. Like, oh my goodness. I mean, that's like Indominus Rex stuff there if you've seen Jurassic World, which I highly recommend you do. And the first game was pretty close, and I got a couple good rolls, and she didn't, and I kind of pulled it out. I bought a little bit wrong to counter the threat. That she was posing. So with my team, I kind of went Prismatic Spray, and as I look back, I'm not sure why on earth I bought Prismatic Spray. I thought maybe just disrupting her ramp would be enough. She wouldn't get to that basic action. What really was important was, how do I deal with Wolverine? So instead, I took a page out of Dean's book, and I already had that Solomon Grundy on my team. He comes up, just knock him out. Bye, Wolverine.
You can just
I was messing
Grundy.
With some retaliation, so that helped me anyway.
You can just park Grundy right in the field, and if you see that Wolverine, you can knock him out. You can even wait till that Wolverine attacks, and then play your global.
Sure, because now they've played at that point. They maybe have played the basic action dice on them and whatever else. Now Lauren was in an interesting spot because she had the Doom Caliber Knight that would prevent characters from being the target of things during the attack step.
Mm.
So. But that also means that she had to play that basic action die before the attack step. So no matter what, I would have the chance to respond. Because if she wanted to put it on later, then I could just knock him out then. If she wanted to put it on now, well, then I could knock him out then too. And you kind of get a little bit of a 2-for-1 there.
Yeah.
And that's pretty awesome. So it's identifying, like, which situations you have. You know, for the team that I was playing, it was like, well, I don't want some of these, like... What will kill me? What will just absolutely destroy me? Big stompy characters. Either wiping my side like Hulk or just coming down my throat like this Wolverine. So I just pack a little bit of useful removal. It doesn't have to be like reinventing the wheel to protect from these threats to your teams. It just has to be a little bit of common sense and how do I use it and when. If you can identify what's on the other side of the board from you, then you're going to be able to deal with it in-game and understand how the tools that you brought with you beforehand can work for you.
Maybe this is getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but that's also a great way to analyze new sets when spoilers are coming out, is to just keep in the back of your mind, like, you know, what does my team need? Man, I really need some kind of better removal. So always be looking at the removal when these new cards are spoiled. Like, oh, that one, that card is what I'm going to need on this team. It's nice to know in the back of your mind, you know, kind of what ways you would improve your team if you could create the card for the scenario.
Yeah, and at the same time, you also have to say, you have to look at ways you can protect your team further. A new set comes out, now all of a sudden, this other card is a big threat to my win condition. How can I guard against that? If there's no easy way of guarding against it, you might need to come up with a new win condition. Because you can't commit a ton of cards to something that you might not see all of the time. You're committing too much of your deck to that. So that's a key point there as well. All right, so overall, though, I think if you work to build decks in this kind of a way, and are really cognizant of not trying to prepare for the meta that you think will be there, but rather just trying to focus your deck and make it do what, you know, make it win the way it wants to win with consistency and with protection. If you have an extra slot and you think, oh, geez, I'm probably going to see this all the time, and you're sure it's an extra slot, okay, put something else in there. But for the most part, if you go with those 3 points, you're going to be able to have some more success with these teams. You're going to have done all the prep that you can, because at the end of the day, you cannot predict. You cannot predict what's going to come at you in one of these events, especially if you do what I think a lot of people were doing after a lot of us overlooked Solomon Grundy, is kind of going back to some of those older sets and looking at a few of those cards again. I will tell you what, I've been looking through so much of Yu-Gi-Oh! And D&D again for things that I missed.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I actually wrote an article about a week and a half ago now, going back through every single global ability in AVX. Mm-hmm. And my next article is going to go through every single global ability of Uncanny, and I'm just going to keep moving along through all the sets until I reach wherever we are currently, because I think there are things that, you know, we miss along the way. I mean, I'll be honest, Yu-Gi-Oh! Had been out for about 2 months before I realized, you know, wait, there's a global that can just flat out force a character to block. All I have to do is pay a fist and I can force a character to block. I had no idea. And I think... Mm-hmm. The more popular this game gets, the bigger it gets, the more people are going to be jumping on. Some of these older cards and older abilities are going to be very, very useful in constructed teams.
Yeah, really try and evaluate the usefulness of a card. What can I do with this one? How can I use it for me? How can I use it? How could it be used against me? Try and understand what some of those things are and look back at those old sets, because I'll tell you what, some of the fun is, it's almost like playing a Metroidvania style game where there's that area you can't get to until you get the gravity boots or something like that. Then you get new abilities and all of a sudden you look back and it's like, oh, now I can get to this thing and I didn't even know this was here. Well, that's kind of what it is here. My goodness, look at what we can do now with Nova, thanks to Slifer, that we couldn't do before. Things like that. Thanks to Magic Missile as well. Same global there. That just changes things. Look at what we can do with that Wolverine now that we have Overcrush. You know? It becomes something wholly different and brand new, even though we've already had this card for a while. It's like that song that, for some reason, you know, from your favorite band that broke up years ago, and there was, for whatever reason, a track on a CD that you never listened to with theirs. It just always got skipped. Now you get something new. That's kind of fun. Because we got new sets coming out. There are spoilers, and we get excited. But then we can find something else new that we already had. We get to rediscover it. And that's so much fun. That's part of the fun of this game. And I love sharing it with all of you.
As do I.
So that brings us to the end of this episode of the Attack Zone. Check us out on the website, on Twitter, everywhere that you can check us out. Interact. We want to hear from you. Otherwise, this is Dave.
And this is Randy.
And this has been the Attack Zone. Thanks for listening.